just in the past 2 or 3 months, 65 central banks of the world haven't begun to dump U.S. currencies. What they've done is they began to add to their currencies, to add with other currencies, but no more buying of dollars. In other words, they're trying to get out of dollars, relatively speaking.
You're listening to Dr. Doug Dowd's public lecture course on economics and the USA, where we are, where we're headed. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, KRFP Moscow, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, KQRP Salida, Free Radio Olympia, WGDR Plainfield, or Free Radio Asheville. We continue with economist Doug Dowd.
There's an old expression which I've given you in something you've been in these classes before will have heard from me. Don't panic. Once you panic, then the whole thing will go down and you'll be hurt too. That's the first phrase. The second phrase is, panic first. So the question is, when does the panic begin? Now, the United States thinks it has some kind of control over the world, especially over junky little countries like China. The United States is treating China in terms of our arguments with them as though this were 100 years ago, or more than that, as though we were asking for the open door policy again and sending in gunboats to be sure that we get them. China's not like that anymore. The Chinese have never felt inferior to the United States. They've had the shit kicked out of them from time to time, but they have never felt inferior. Ask any Chinese who's really Chinese, what does the expression center of the earth refer to? To us, the Chinese will say. They were here a little bit before us, you know. We're crudies. And they have us by the short hair now. I must say, even though I'm not a fan of China, because I don't like slave labor and things like that, nevertheless, I get a certain kind of twisted satisfaction out of the fact that the Chinese have got us by the short hairs. Anyhow, these are some of the ways in which things are different. Now I want to get to the point. What's also going on now, whether it's different or not from Britain, and it is very different, but that's not the point anymore. What's going on now within the United States, and to a certain degree outside of the United States, is a set of processes in which power, already concentrated, is becoming always more concentrated. Economic power, just look at the mergers and acquisitions. They're just going on. They're going on at a rate now which is like the 90s and the 80s, in which the biggest corporations join with the biggest corporations. Just today, Chevron and Unocal is announced are going to join. Chevron is already Chevron Texaco, okay? And they've taken over Unocal. So they'd be number two under ExxonMobil, which used to be the... Well, ExxonMobil actually is sort of unfair to talk about it because they used to be two of the companies in what used to be Standard Oil, which broke up into 23 companies. Now it got back to six, and now it's gotten up to two again. And Chevron was one of the old Standard Oil companies. But the power, the AIG that this insurance thing that just got is going through hell now, was a conglomeration of dozens and dozens and dozens of insurance companies. And so on it is, whether it's in production, finance, insurance, whatever it is. There's a tremendous concentration of economic power and a concentration of political power that is unlike anything we've ever seen in the United States before, qualitatively or quantitatively. At the same time, what there is a population, people of the United States, which I think a decent survey, that is to say an accurate survey, a well-conducted survey, would show that most of the people in the United States, meaning that something well over a good strong majority, are really pissed off, really unhappy. A really good book was written 25 years ago by a top-level economist called The Joyless Economy, The Economy Without Joy, by a guy named Skatovsky, taught at Stanford at the time. The joyless economy. Everybody's buying, borrowing, and just really nervous and pissed off all the time. Pissed off at what? Costs so much to get those prescriptions. costs so much to pay that doctor. It costs so much to pay for gasoline. The gasoline has doubled since the 6 months that I was away from San Francisco this year. It's doubled. And it was already too high. It costs so much for rents. It costs so much for this. It costs so much for that. And I got to work so much now, overtime without overtime pay. And everything is sort of the material lives of people. And the troubles they're having with their kids, whether their kids are 4 years old or 14 years old. Everything is sort of nerve-wracking now, more than ever before. And at the same time, these same people, the same substantial great majority of people, is very much opposed to people who would say, well, we need to change this, that, and the other way, and very much acquiescing in the people who are making an already terrible society worse for most of the people, at the same time as, of course, a tiny percentage, 5%, are so rich they can't sleep thinking about, God damn that guy, his yacht is 1 foot longer than mine. There was an article about this in Fortune magazine recently about the rich buying these yachts for $250 million and then say, no, make it bigger because Jack's is bigger. And we're talking about people who are crazy. We're talking about this guy, what was his name, in Tyco, who paid $6,000 for a shower curtain. I mean, these people are demented people and envied, very much envied, jealous of each other. They're crazy people. They're literally crazy. They're literally demented people, deranged, unbalanced, because they want something that doesn't make any sense at all except in terms of kind of an insane competition between themselves and other deranged people. And Bush is one of those people. Now, I asked you when we started today, how many of you knew anything about the New South? Well, what this book is about that I'm writing, that I've written, is the United States as a nation is moving toward becoming what the New South was. The New South existed from 1877 until the 1960s. Okay? The New South came into existence and became, listen to me carefully, became a colony of the United States with the Compromise of 1877. Quite literally, a colony, an economic colony. Now, Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was no hero of mine, but who was no fool, once said when he was a senator, I don't know what prompted him to say this. He was talking about Vietnam before he became president. He was talking about the French and Vietnam. He was saying that a colony of a great power, takes on the worst characteristics of the power that dominates it and exaggerates them. What became the United States was a colony of Great Britain, which had many defects. And the United States took those defects and made them into institutions. What defects? Well, lust for money. Racism. Racism? The British racism? How could you say that? Well, ask the Irish. My mother was a Jew. My father was an Irish Catholic. And his people came over to this country, to San Francisco, as it happens, to get away from the famine of Ireland. That famine was not a famine at all. It was starvation by the British of the Irish. The Irish were exporting food to England while they were starving. The population of Ireland in 1840 was 9 million. You know what it is now? It's 4 million. It's the only place in the world where that's happened. And most of the millions either died or left. My great-grandparents among them. What the English did to the Irish, beginning in the late medieval, but coming to a wonderful crescendo in the 17th century, was they made slaves, pigs, out of the Irish, made them into, I'm going to use this word with quotation, made niggers out of them. Karl Marx, incidentally, wrote when he was writing for the Herald Tribune back in the 19th century. He wrote that the attitudes of the English worker toward the Irish worker in England And these were Irish who, of course, left England, left Ireland in order to get work in England. We're talking about the 19th century. Marx didn't write about the 20th century. The English treat the Irish workers, and Marx said this, like niggers, and he put quotation marks around it, are treated in the United States. The English had a word for everybody outside of England. Wogs. Everyone was a wog. The French were wogs, to say nothing of the Africans, to say nothing of those in India. Wogs. That is to say, not really human at all. So we imported the racism of the British and made an institution of it. We call it slavery. We made an institution of it with the what we called Indians, who never called themselves Indians, and wiped them out because they weren't really human. They still are not really human. Racism became one of the dominating characteristics of what it means to be in the United States. We're the most racist country in history in terms of the numbers of people we despise, we are contemptuous of, we mistreat, we lynch, we exploit. We have people from hundreds of places over the earth. They've got a dirty name for every one of them. I won't go through them. And the interesting, awful, stupid, self-destructive thing about it is that those of us for whom there is a dirty name have a dirty name for others. We all play the same dirty, fucking, stupid, self-destructive game. My father was a Mick, which is a dirty word. My mother was a kike, which is a dirty word, etc., etc., etc. And now we've got a dirty word. It's about time, the f***ing Iraqis, Hajis. Makes us all feel good, huh? Powerful, better than the others. Makes us all exploitable, economically, politically, everyone. So the United States, before it was the United States, while we were still colonies, we were a country of people in which what was becoming taken for granted was the orchestrated use of violence against, quote, Indians, to say nothing of against, quote, slaves. Although less against slaves than against Indians, because slaves were private property. Got to be careful of private property. And then against one group after another. There were 100 million, quote, Indians in the Western Hemisphere when Columbus landed. By 1900, there were 10 million. In 1800, and this is not just a symbolic thing I'm going to tell you, in 1800, according to the Department of Agriculture, there were 60 million buffalo in the United States. In 1900, there were 1,500, and they were killed for fun. You'd go across the prairie on a train and had benches on the side, and you paid money to sit on the benches with your gun shooting the buffalo, leaving miles and miles of corpses, destroying the Indian culture in the process. This is the sort of thing the United States was, became. I'm not saying there's nothing good about the United States. I love what was good about it, what could be good about it. I'm very much, quote, an American, and I don't like the word American. But I know shit when I see it and smell it, and it's not the same thing as applesauce. Well, what happened was the United States became a nation. And in that nation, 1776 on, 1789 on, the kinds of institutions that were taken for granted, profited from, employed, were institutionalized greed, institutionalized racism, and a happy inclination toward violence and militarism and guns. And when the South was beaten in the Civil War, it was occupied. Now, the South was not just a place where there was slavery at one point. The South happened to have, if those 11 states were taken as a group, happened to have the best resources, all in all, of all any 11 states in the United States. The South was occupied. I'm going to tell you about this because we weren't given this much. I never learned this myself until I had a PhD and started to study the South and live in it for a while. The South was occupied. The troops went in. The slaves were freed. They could go to school. They could sit in a restaurant. Not to say that this is a big deal, but they could sit in a restaurant. They could go in a railroad station. They could go pee in a toilet. where a white person could pee in the toilet. They were, in another sense, given they had the same freedom or the same rights as whites did, in principle. And because this went so much against the grain of the Southern whites, they had to have the troops there to enforce it. And it was a terrible, terrible period for the whites. The rich whites, the poor whites. And a deal was made in 1877. There was an election. If this reminds you of the 2000 election, please don't tell me about it. There was an election which the man who won the most votes did not become president. The one who got less votes, if we were to do it by today's measures, 2 million less votes, two or three million fewer votes, came to be president. Tilden was the one who got the votes. Hayes was the one who became president. And that was a decision made in Congress, okay? It was a decision that was made by a compromise between the Northern and Southern representatives. And what was the compromise? The compromise was that Northern capital would have free access to all of what it wanted in the South. All of its resources, it could build factories there, build railroads there, it all controlled the economic, it was going to be an economic colony of the North. And the South could have freedom to do whatever they wanted to do with respect to anything political, cultural, social, except slavery. So the South reintroduced slavery without slavery. You're all familiar with lynching. There were very few lynchings in the South until after 1877. As I said a moment ago, you don't lynch your property. You don't kill your property. But there were no slaves. So you began to get thousands of people were lynched. They were black people, of course. Men, women, and children. Mostly men. But it isn't just that. You've got all the things that were fought against in the 50s and the 60s, came to be called civil rights movement. All those things were just simply civil wrongs became the norm. Not only that, something very, very important happened. Because the South was run, essentially, by the people who had the most money in the South, their business, the economy, was run by Northern capital, but the local life was run by the people who had the most money. And because the poor whites were like the English with respect to the Irish in Britain, because the poor whites had this sense, wonderful sense of superiority against them, black people, the poor whites became really poor. I mean, they were the ones who worked in the factories, the Northern factories, Northern-owned factories. Incidentally, this is one of the first movements of globalization, but within the United States, where the people in New England, where the factories were closed because the cheap labor was so cheap in the South. All white. No black people worked in those factories or in those mines. All white. Poor whites. They were called poor whites. And these poor whites were ruled over by the same politicians year after year after year after year after year. So that you got what was claimed to be called the solid South. Solid meaning solidly democratic. And the same people who were elected this year will be elected 10 years from now over and over and over again. And what this meant was that these people, these men, I should say, because of the rules they have in Congress, have to do with seniority. The committees, congressional committees, came to be dominated by Southerners because they were there the whole time. The Supreme Court came to be dominated by Southerners. Congress and the Supreme Court, what more do you want? And the Democratic Party, of course, was dominated by Southerners until you get into the New Deal in the 30s. From that point on, then the Democratic Party became very unpopular in the South as time went on. And now, of course, it's the Republicans. It's the solid Republican South now. But what the South was a region in which all of what was wrong with the United States became institutionalized, became normal, became like steel, in which you had a society that was ruled plutocratically, like a dictatorship, except a dictatorship in which the mass of the white population wouldn't think of any change. It was just fine. Something has to be understood about democracy. It's very dangerous unless the people are informed, concerned, and active. Informed doesn't mean informed by an owned media. It means informed. And conscious, class conscious. One of the things that was true of the New South was that they gave up class consciousness. Here were the most exploited workers in the whole capitalist world. Was in the New South. Worse than Germany. And Germany was terrible. The most exploited workers, with no class consciousness whatsoever. They were race conscious. Now when I say, and this is the point of this whole book, when I say that the United States as a nation is becoming what the South was, as the New South, I'm not saying that it's jot and tittle. It couldn't be. I'm not saying it's going to be the same thing where we're going to be poor whites and they're going to go back to exploiting the blacks or lynching blacks. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that we're moving toward, we are already well into it, we're up to our knees in it already, into being a self-destructive, irrational, dominated society by a handful, a few thousand people dominated. We're people who don't give a shit about anything that most Americans think we should be proud of being. Whether they practice it or not is another question, of course. Bush, Karl Rove, Tom DeLay, Frist, all of them Southerners, incidentally. Have you noticed that? Except that Bush is a phony Southerner. But that's the worst kind. That's the worst kind. Because what Bush is doing is making believe that he is the essence of what is worst about the South. The militarism, the machoism, the greed, the dishonesty, the arrogance, the love of violence, the cowardice. He's a fucking coward. He's a brute. All brutes are cowards. I'm going to give you a little parenthesis here. Bush and his father, both pilots, so was I. Bush and his father, both pilots. It was common knowledge about Bush 1, George H.W. Bush. When he was a pilot during World War II in the Pacific, which is where I was, when he was a pilot, he was shot down, given a medal for it. He had a crew of two. He was a naval pilot. He had a crew of two. He bailed out. They didn't. Now, I was a pilot. You don't do that. You just don't do that. Okay? You can't do that. You would kill yourself before you would bail out. It's like the captain of a ship, the old sentimental saying, the captain goes down with the ship. You don't bail out unless your crew has gotten out first. Bush did that. It was common knowledge. When I say common, I don't mean everybody. It was in the newspapers, and then it was stifled. This came out when he was running for president. Bush, too, as you all know, because this has been in the newspapers, but somehow or another, it doesn't seem to make any difference. But he was a pilot during the Vietnam War, but never went overseas, never got involved. Now, how did that happen? Or to put it differently, if he were the kind of guy he makes believe he is, he would have been one of the first pilots over in Vietnam, rather than never going at all. He used his power, his privilege, his status, his money, his father, blah, 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 blah. And yet, he's been elected almost once, and really elected probably, maybe, the second time. Or to put it differently, even if he didn't get 70 million votes or 60 million, he did, in fact, get, even if he'd lost, he would have had 40 million votes at least. I mean, what are we doing in this country? What we are doing is, not all of us who vote for Bush, but too many of us are wannabes. We so much wish, and we have been taught this, we so much wish we could be rich and powerful and all this stuff, that we don't pay much attention to the kind of shit that gets to be that way. That's one of the biggest things that's wrong with our country. We've been bamboozled, and we like it. We've been derailed. We've become irrational. We've become self-destructive people. We've become like the poor whites. Because the people who are angriest of all after the Civil War were the poor whites. More angry than the plantation owners. Because they had reasons to be angry. They were poor. They had lousy lives. And one good thing in their life had been the black. They had power over black people. And we're being taught today that we have some kind of powers First place, we're the best people in the world. We know that. We're the bravest people in the world, the most courageous people in the world, the most idealistic people in the world. Why, we're willing to do anything to spread freedom and democracy over the world, so long as it doesn't mean that we have to do, and so on, and so on, and so on. I'm really interested in the kind of military statistics sort of thing, because I'm somebody who really hates the military, really hates war. I earned the right to hate the military with 4 years of it. I really am interested in the fact that so many people in this country, when one American soldier is killed, to say nothing of, my God, 1,500. This is so, how awful. We've got to use bigger bombs, better planes, and so on. And we pay no attention whatsoever to the fact, when I say no attention, I mean not more than a tenth of a tenth of 1% of people in this country have the foggiest idea of how many Iraqis have been killed in that war. But it's known. It's known that over 100,000, mostly civilians, are killed, dead, because of the war. Who gives a shit about that? In this country, I had a friend, professor friend, some years ago, who said, the people in the United States don't hate war enough. Why should we? All it ever affects is maybe half of 1% of our population, except the Civil War. Civil War knocked out 600,000 soldiers, killed them. More than all the soldiers put together killed since then in U.S. wars, Civil War. I think what this class is about is to try to understand what's going on. What's going on sitting at the center of it is capitalism and its economics. But I tried to say earlier this evening, you can't talk about economic affairs without relating them to everything else. And when you look at what's going on in the White House, for example, right now, the people who are most influential in there are people whose influence comes from their economic power. This is what the class is going to be about this semester. And I'll go back and look at that outline again. Chapter 1 is the United States becomes its own worst enemy. Chapter 2 is the realities and trends of the United States economy. Chapter 3 is human and social needs, which has a lot to do with economics. Chapter 4 is U.S. militarism. Chapter 5 is the environment. Chapter 6 is about inequality, ideology, politics, and the media.
He mentioned that globalization is like a giant tractor mashing its way across the planet, which is, you described, as different from colonialization in earlier times. Could you tie that into maybe the leadership change? It seems to me like our government is really representing global capitalists as opposed to American people.
Well, of course, I wouldn't disagree with that at all. It's representing basically the kind of economic policy that comes out of our government is necessarily a political economic policy, because you can't do it without politics. But it's a policy which is responding to the pressures and the desires of mostly the largest corporations, which are all called transnational corporations now. And the very word transnational didn't even exist until the 80s. Before that, it became, in the 60s, we began to talk about multinational corporations. There were, ever since industrialism began, there were corporations that had plants and so on, and operations outside of their own country. But nothing like what began to take place in the 60s and what is now going on with transnational corporations. Now, the thing is that no major producing company, or financial company now, can't function unless it functions internationally. And so you have these, what we have now, the norm for the giant corporation now is to be a corporation that has no limits in terms of what its focus is. That is to say, it will be simultaneously producing, be industrial. Simultaneously, with industrial, it'll be trading. Simultaneously a financial company. Quite often now, simultaneously a media company. In other words, there's, in some sense or another, each transnational corporation, in some sense, represents a whole economy. Okay, and they go hither, thither, and yon, driven by where they can make the most money at the least risk. And it has been a process that is cutting their own throat. And China is a beautiful example. China was the place where the biggest corporations began to go because the labor was so very, very cheap there. I mean, it's so cheap it's hard even for us to imagine. But the Chinese have now become their own producers. There are General Motors plants in China, but there are now Chinese companies producing automobiles. And one of the things that's interesting is that they're producing very small automobiles, relatively speaking. And those are the ones that people are buying in China. Chinese market is the most promising market for all, let's call them, consumer goods, especially consumer durable goods, among other things. Their labor force is simultaneously the cheapest or close to the cheapest in the world. India comes very close or beats them. And India is very much like China in every respect I'm speaking of. Not only the cheapest, it's also the most skilled. It's also got the highest tech sort of level to it. So that what China is doing is becoming, in some sense or another, the Germany. What Germany was in the late 19th century, where Germany was, as some of you know, if you were looking for the society in the 19th century, late 19th century, which was best educated, most scientifically advanced, etc., 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 it was Germany. And all of a sudden, taking in capital from Britain, taking in financial capital from Britain, it became better than anyone else. Better than the United States technologically, incidentally, at that time. And so the Chinese are doing that now, as the Japanese did that before, that is, say, right after World War II, especially, the Japanese began to bypass the United States technologically. The Chinese are doing that now. At the same time, they have the cheapest labor force in the world, just about. Not only that, think of a population of 1.3 billion people, or a little bit more, and they have an unemployment rate, not rate, they have about 600 million people who are unemployed, or half employed. They have so many people, and people who A, willing to work, desperate to work for practically nothing, B, willing to do almost everything at every skill very, very well, and cheaply. And it so happens, when we read about this terrible low-wage sort of thing that's going on in China, it's also true that they have the best purchasing power in the world. Okay, if you get $2,000 a year in China, you can buy five times as much with that as you can in the United States. And if you're in the cities, and in some cases if you're in the provinces, you also have access to health care, education, and housing. We pay for all of that. Not all of it yet, just yet, but just wait a while. And so on and so on and so on. Anyhow, so the main push behind globalization has come from the transnational corporations. And it would be inconceivable in Washington, whether you're speaking to Congress now or the White House, not to, in effect, take the needs and the desires of the major corporations as, in some sense, the compass for policy. I mean, it would be inconceivable. In other words, I couldn't understand it myself if they didn't do that. Because there's no pressure coming on them from any other source except organized labor, okay? And organized labor, to talk about organized labor's pressure, is like talking about my muscles. I practically don't have any muscles at all. Nor does organized labor. The peak of organized labor's political power was in the 60s. At that point, about a third of the workforce, industrial workforce, was organized. Now it's 8%, talking about the private labor force. With just a third was not enough. It's crazy for it to only be a third, because that was also a time when we were a highly industrialized country. Now, 8%. Well, with few exceptions, when there's collective bargaining today, whether it's in the automobile industry, or the steel industry, the electrical product, when there's organized collective bargaining today, the main thing that's going on from the point of view of labor is which concessions will we make? You understand? What are we going to give up? How are we going to save whom? In other words, what will we give up in order not to lose too much and so on? And it's understandable they're doing that. They don't have any political power at all. None. And in their industry, every worker knows, every union leader knows, and almost all of them are in the first place corrupted anyway. But quite apart from that, almost all of them, not all of them, but almost all of them. But they all know, or they're all threatened with this. Listen, if you don't concede, overseas we go. So you concede, and overseas they go anyway. I mean, This country has only had a few burping moments of class consciousness. Late 19th century, early 20th century, 30s, 40s, 50s. And you just need it all the time. When all you've got is your numbers to have power, you better, by God, do it all the time. Work with those numbers. We just don't do it. And we don't do it because it isn't because we lack character in this country. It's just that our character is, we got a lot of character. It's just bad character, that's all. Our bad character is we've been taught to be greedy. We've been taught to want things, as Paul Baron said, and I say this all the time. We've been taught, we have learned to want things very, very much that we don't need, and not to want things that we do need. We'll break our asses to get that new television set that's newsworthy, watching shit all the time. And we won't do anything to see to it that we have adequate health care for ourselves or our kids or our parents or whatever. Nothing. In fact, we will be suspicious of people, even talk about it, and so on. We're the new South. We're self-destructive. We're irrational. Now, this isn't because we don't have the possibility inside ourselves to be sane human beings. It's we've been socialized so really effectively, much more so than any people in the whole of history. Socialized. Happily socialized. Yes?
Where do you feel that the union strength in this city lies relative to your comment that you just made on the national level? Do you feel the unions are more empowered locally here?
I'll ask Jerry to answer that. Why don't you answer that, Jerry? Because Jerry's a union guy. He knows more about it than I do.
He had just gone through how he feels what's happening to the unions nationally is makes them very weak. Do you feel that they are in a weakened state in the city?
Yes. with Schwarzenegger as governor, that's the political power that we have, you know, in this city is really, it's very weak. I mean, you represent the spirit, there's much less organized labor in San Francisco now than there was certainly 30 years ago.
This is it's really interesting to see what's happened in San Francisco, of all places. Because San Francisco had the most extraordinary and admirable labor movement in the whole goddamn country, as symbolized, but not only that, just symbolized by the ILWU. What the ILWU did in the 1930s was absolutely impossible, but they did it. Okay, I was paying attention to that. That's what made me pay attention. 1934, the general strike, I was 15 years old. And I can tell you what went on then, that year, and after that, with the ILWU. And ILWU, unfortunately, represents all too well what's happened to organized labor in this country. Because it went through holy hell to become a really powerful and really admirable union. Having become so, it then began to relax and help to destroy itself. Now, I'm not saying that it ever had it easy, that there was ever a period in which the ILWU would find easily solutions to keep on being admirable from the point of view of workers and other human beings like myself. But what they did was they got their power, and when the threats began to come in from modern docking and shipping and so on, they began to work. They began, really, for some sort of another, they were sort of the beginnings of concessionary unionism. This wonderful union. It became a union of people who were holding on. Those who managed to survive in the union are really well off. And this is characteristic, whether it's the electrical workers, the steel workers, the auto workers, or whatever. That is to say, once they had it made, I might say it's not just the United States, it's also true in Italy, where I spend a lot of time. Once the workers have it made, they just fall into the system of it's each for himself and God for all.
There's another side to that, too.
Tell me.
It wasn't just like that. I mean, you had the National Association of Manufacturers conducting incredible anti-union campaign.
Oh, certainly.
You had a society and a culture that's been actively anti-union. It's not been passive. One of the things that I was going to ask you about is, do you remember Operation Dixie in 1946?
Operation what?
It was the U.S. labor movement.
Operation Dixie.
Dixie. Operation Dixie.
Dixie, yeah.
The U.S. labor movement, AFL-CIO, decided to organize the black people in the textile industry in the South. And when they started moving into that area, something happened. Evidently, the textile mill owners, who were giving a lot of money to the Democratic Party, decided this was not something they wanted to see. And they threatened to pull it out, and because labor was so tightly linked to the Democratic Party, they pulled back that organizing effort. I think it was 1946, 48, something like that. And this, again, it wasn't a good thing to happen, but I wondered if you knew anything about why that occurred.
Not that particular end of it, no.
But it's not been passive. It's been all passive.
What's been true of organized labor in this country is true for the whole of the society now. That is to say, organized labor, the organization of workers into unions, effective, honest unions, has always been a terribly steep uphill battle in this country. And yet, more than once, many, many times, that uphill battle has been taken on and won for a while, okay? What has not ever happened in this country is for those who have the strength to fight that battle have not also seen the need, not just to take care of themselves, but to see to it that there is a labor movement, that without a labor movement there cannot be even one strong union unless it's totally corrupted, for its own workers totally corrupted, and so on. We don't have, you were saying it in different words, we don't have anything like a sense of class consciousness as something to be intense about, proud of. Class consciousness is not something we don't see ourselves as workers in the first place. We don't want to see ourselves as workers. We want to see ourselves, Bush is smart, or Karl Rove, I should say, is smart. Ownership society. You're going in a sinking boat. You want to own the boat you're sinking in. No, I mean, we've got this kind of ideology, I have not ever been without hope, and I'm not without hope now. I'm scared out of my wits. I've been scared lots of times in my life, but that doesn't mean you're without hope. The last chapter of this book, the epilogue, talks about this, and it's, incidentally, I should have said this, it's on our class website. The preface and the epilogue are on the website if you want to look it up. And I think it's under What's New or something like that. And if you don't know, the website is www.dougdowd.org, not .com. In Italy, they say vu, not www. Yes.
In the light of September 11th and the resource depletion peak oil.
Pardon?
In light of those two things.
Peak oil.
Peak oil and September 11th.
Yeah.
Two stolen elections, etc.
Well, that makes both of those things make a bad situation worse. For one thing, 9/11 made it so easy for irrationality to be exploited through fear. I mean, I said some minutes ago, people in the United States don't hate war enough. We don't hate war enough because we haven't been harmed enough by it except the Civil War. And for that very same reason, we're very easily scared because we have no experience with hard times when it comes to war. We think it's hard times when, I mean, Bush, for example, on tonight's news, I almost threw up. He gave a little speech for the soldier who got the medal after he's died, of course, and made a big speech about this guy doing these things, brave things, no question about it. But he talked about it as though there's something, some big deal about the whole thing. Death by violence, warfare, is something which is in some sense another moving picture for us. And when somebody really does get killed, 1,500 soldiers get killed, or 2,000 or 3,000 people get killed because of the Twin Towers sort of thing. That's very easy to exploit us. We're a nation, to put it differently, that is essentially cowardly. We're worried all the time for getting hurt about one thing or another. At the same time that we're violent, and so on and so on. But we're brutes about it. That is to say, we like violence because we think we can get away with it, we won't get hurt, we won't get punished, and so on and so on and so on. Maybe you don't understand what I'm saying when I say we're a nation like that. We're a very violent country. That's how we became a nation, was through violence, through killing all those Indians, moving through all that territory, kicking the French out, kicking the Spanish out, kicking the British out, kicking everyone out, you know, and Cuba, Vietnam, Central Africa, Central America, all this, violence. We think of ourselves as a peace-loving country. We're just the opposite. If those of you have seen my encyclopedia that Ruth was showing, a two-volume encyclopedia, if you look under wars, militarism, I should say, you'll find that we had 150 undeclared wars, to say nothing of the declared wars. 150 undeclared wars between 1789 and 1941. 150 of them. You understand? And we just get away with it because we always had more weaponry than the people. We're brutes. I mean, for us to go across the whole continent, knocking down the Redskins, as we like to call them. They had bows and arrows. We had cannon. We had guns, and so on. We had trains. We had everything. It's disgusting. I mean, I've been in a war. Scared shitless most of the time. Why? Because the guys on the other side were armed just as well as we were. Guns against guns. Planes against planes, until the last year of the war. Then it got to be easy. Very easy with Hiroshima. We like Hiroshima kind of things. We don't pay any attention at all to what we do with that kind of stuff. We're a brute country. Now, I said a long time ago this evening, I think at least a third of the people in this country don't go for any of that stuff. They don't do anything about it. They like to see something done about it. They don't do anything about it. Because we have this notion in this country, we've been taught this. What does it mean to be political? It means to vote. Now let's see, what do I want? I'm having a hell of a time making up my mind. I don't know whether I, Tweedledee or Tweedledum is the, D-dum, I don't like dumb. I'll go for D. Bush, Kerry. I voted for Kerry. But I voted for Kerry. Because Kerry, as bad as he is, and he's really bad, a real political coward, if ever there was one, a self-destructive political coward. But Bush, it isn't Bush, is the kind of people he's got with him are really absolutely, totally ruthless people. This is different. This, what we have now with this Bush administration is the latest stage in something that's been emerging like a snake coming out of the bushes since the 1970s. And it always has a front to it. The best front of all was Reagan. Total phony, baloney shithead of a guy, but charming. I mean, you're going to have charming shit's okay. Coward. Another coward. Do you know that Reagan almost didn't become president of the United States for one reason? He was scared of flying. He flew once when he was governor from L.A. to Catalina Island and wet his pants. He said, I'll never fly again. It just scared the shit out of him. But when he wanted to run for president, they said, look, Ronnie, you've got to go all over the country. You can't go by horse or by train. You've got to fly. So, he was a total coward. And he, of course, came on the screen as, Mr. Muscle kind of a guy. And Bush is the same kind of a way. But so are the American people. I'm a coward, too. But I'm not prone to violence. I'm not a brute. I'm a coward. I shit my pants at least 50 times when I was a pilot. They have in all the planes, the combat planes, they have what they call a piss tube. It's for peeing. But they didn't have anything for a bowel movement. Now, you really get scared, you your pants. The first thing you do when you land is you change your pants. You know, I'm not ashamed of being scared. On the other hand, I don't go out looking for physical violence either, or ask anyone else to do it. The United States is a country which we like that kind of stuff, so long as it doesn't hurt me, you know, and so on. And we have a president who's like that. We've had more than one president like that. We don't pay much enough attention to it. What we mostly don't do is we don't do anything about it except bemoan it. We've got to stop bemoaning, yes.
You mentioned that a few months ago, central banks around the world stopped buying U.S. currency.
And didn't stop. They reduced it. They're replacing their U.S. currency. They're holding on to it.
Okay.
There's always an addition. There's always, so long as growth is taking place, and it is taking place slowly or rapidly, depending, then there's also a need for more currency to be exchanged, okay?
Okay, my question was, A, what is the function of central banks around the world purchasing U.S. currency? And B, what is the byproduct of them slowing down their purchase or selling off our currency?
Well, if they start selling off our currency, then the dollar gets lower and lower, okay? And that means that it becomes more and more expensive for people to sell things. It becomes more difficult to sell things to us, okay? But the United States, the Bush administration, when I say Bush, I mean the administration, the brains so-called behind, they are saying, let this go, okay? They're letting the dollar become cheaper and cheaper because it means that our exports would become cheaper and cheaper to the rest of the world. They're doing this because it's good, in quotes, for American industry. But it isn't, because at the very time that our exports become cheaper, their exports to us become more expensive, right? What's happening in Europe is that they're all in trouble because they can't export enough. Their exports, their ability to export. What we're doing is we are, in effect, harming Europe by letting the dollar decline. Okay. Now, Europe is only one of our major areas that we have to be concerned with. Latin America, Asia is another one. And the Asians are themselves in a position where, I mean, the Japanese, for example, are in terrible trouble right now. Every 2 months or so, you see an article in the paper saying Japanese economic growth is going up and up and up and up, meaning it's going over 1%. It has to be over 3%. And then a week later, you say, no, they made a mistake. It's going down instead. And so on. The South Koreans are in trouble. The only ones who aren't in trouble are the Chinese and the Indians, incidentally. And as I will try to say when we get into the later meetings, talk about this, what does it affect Chapter 2, we're in a real bind. The world economy is in a real bind. The United States cannot be made to do anything different from what it's doing. And the United States itself doesn't dare to do anything different than what it's doing, and the other nations don't dare to. And so what we're doing is, in some sense or another, we're already over-indebted. I mean terribly over-indebted. There's lots of discussion about this, mainstream discussion, not just freaks like me, about how dangerous this is becoming. And yet everyone knows, including the people who say how dangerous it is, that if we reverse this situation, everything will collapse. Understand? So what we're in is a situation in which we're postponing disaster by continuing to do the same thing more and more rapidly. It's like somebody who's on a binge who, if he or she stops drinking, will have a hell of a flump. So they keep drinking, and the flump is going to be much bigger. And we're talking now about the world economy, and when you're talking about the world economy, you're talking about world politics, and you're talking about world peace. Don't kid. And if you stick oil into it, and you cannot not stick oil into it. And you ask, what kinds of tensions are, and I'll be talking about this later on, but what kinds of tensions now, given the fact that we're in a very tense world, for a variety of reasons, you stick oil into that equation or that situation. Just stick China in there with oil. The United States is the biggest oil user and biggest oil importer in the world. China's number two. And China just keeps going up and up and up and up. And it isn't using oil just for automobiles. It's using oil as we're using oil for everything. Everything is oil, okay? Everything is oil. Our clothing, our refrigerators, our everything. Everything is produced is using oil in one way or another, to one degree or another, and more and more and more. And as some of you in this room know very well, because it's now become a common knowledge, it's peaked. Finding of oil has peaked. It's peaked at the same time finding that the resources of oil have peaked at the same time the uses are going up at naturally an accelerating rate. Where is most of the oil? Most of the oil, not all of it, most of it's in, what's the name of that area? Middle East. Oh, yeah, Middle East. Now, Middle East happens to be, in the first place, the people who live in the Middle East don't call it the Middle East any more than the people who live in the Far East call it the Far East. That's a Western term, you understand, West European term. The Chinese think of themselves as the center of the earth, and they don't want to even talk about the poops anyplace else. But as it happens, in the Middle East, bounding the Middle East is Central Asia. Up above is, what's the name of that country? Russia, big oil. Okay, and then there's that place called China. And all of them are looking at the Middle East the way a wolf looks at a rabbit. And then you have oil resources, Latin America, a place called Venezuela or something like that. I never can get the stupid names. And so on and so on. And who's going to control it? The Chinese, incidentally, have just bought properties in Venezuela. And so on. And if you had leaders throughout the world who were ideally sane, ideally informed, ideally decent, it would be extremely difficult to resolve the problems that we now face, the ones I've been talking about, which are not all of them. But when you have these horses' asses, greedy, power drunk, horses' asses, all in competition with each other, it's time for people to get control. We aren't very good, but we're in the wrong hands. Time to run away. The next class is the third Monday, which is the 18th of April. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the first in a series of lectures on The USA, Where We Are, Where We're Headed by Professor Doug Dowd, his 2005 public course. For more on Doug Dowd's work, see his website, www.dougdowd.org. That's DougDowd.org. Thanks to Michael Slaughter of Vivecchio Press, Michael Hirohama, Mike Thornton, and Tracy James of Slave Revolt Radio for their contributions to this week's program. You can contact us on the web at www.unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome traps.